was up there beyond the sky. It's been a long.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KABU for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. That's Drinking for Puddles, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yeah.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
Coming up this morning on KABU at 8 or at 9 next, it's Bookwaves with acclaimed author Richard Powers and his latest novel, Overstory, dealing with ecological warriors trying to save the planet. At 9:30, the Radio Zine hosts a conversation with Under the Tuscan Sun author Frances Mays about her latest book, Women in Sunlight. At 10, Air Cascadia, and at 10:15, Flashpoints. At 11, on The Recovery Zone, writer Rory Scranton talks about his book, We're Doomed, Now What? Essays on War and Climate Change. And all of these programs are made possible by member support. And if you'd like to become a member, go to kabu.fm and click on Donate. This KABU program is made possible by KABU member listeners and support from Oregon Symphony, located at 909 Southwest Washington Street in downtown Portland. Presenting Gary Trudeau, political cartoonist and creator of Doonesbury Comics, sharing from his latest book, Sad, Doonesbury in the Time of Trump. Tuesday, October 16th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more information available by phone at 503-228-1353 or online at orsymphony.org.
Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Richard Powers, whose latest novel is The Overstory. Other novels, Orfeo, Echo Maker, The Time of Our Singing. I believe this is the 12th novel, and this one deals with trees. What brought you to write The Overstory?
That's a good question. I'd written 11 novels over the course of almost a third of a century. And the novels had had many different concerns and topics, music, game theory, business, you name it, I've tried to write about it. But mostly I've tried to write about the larger frameworks, the larger context for human activity, to put private, personal stories in the setting of more sweeping, wider political and social and scientific concerns. I had, however, missed a huge part of the story, which is the story of humans trying or not trying, succeeding or failing to live in the world beyond the human, to come to terms with the natural world, the world of non-humans that isn't operating on our time frame or with our values or toward our ends. I was living in Stanford and teaching there and in the heart of Silicon Valley and the craziness that comes when you compress a lot of money and power and ingenuity and invention into a small part of the world. And I was getting up into the Santa Cruz Mountains as a kind of getaway from the go-go life down in the valley. And as a lot of people in this area know, there's huge amounts of gorgeous set-aside open space preserve there. You can walk from San Francisco to San Jose on open space land. And a lot of that land is second growth redwood, which is a magnificent experience. I mean, people here know it quite well and maybe even take it for granted. But for a Midwesterner like myself, it was eye-opening. It was just like stepping into the largest and most beautiful cathedral I'd ever been in. And I guess one day walking around in those forests, those regrown forests up near Skyline, I came across an old one. And I had been marveling at what a redwood could do in 100 years. It's a magnificent, fast-growing, immense and imposing tree, even at a century, at a millennium out of this world. And it just becomes another kind of reality altogether. And looking at this thing that was, you know, as wide as a house and as tall as a football field and 1,000, 2,000 years old, you know, I just had a flash of, you know, a vision almost of what these forests must have looked like before they went under the saw to build and to rebuild San Francisco. And I thought of that sense of, you know, that Silicon Valley was down there because these forests were up here. The forests made it possible. And I thought, I've never seen that story treated in literary fiction before. I'd like to give it a try.
At what point was that in your writing?
I hadn't quite finished the previous book, but it was in hand. And as usual, each of these books grows out of the unsolved problems of the previous one. The previous book was about an avant-garde composer who has one last hurrah, one last transgressive act that gets him in trouble with the powers that be, and is unwittingly labeled a bioterrorist. But I wanted to explore that notion of what it would take to put a person at odds with the status quo, with the law, for purposes bigger than themselves. When might it be justified? What might push a law-abiding person over the edge? And that's why my novel about bioterrorism was followed by this much larger, much more expansive novel about eco-terrorism, but also simply about eco-affirmation, about learning to see the world that isn't our world.
Had you finished the novel by the time Trump was elected? And if you hadn't, did that change your perception of what you were saying?
You know, the book was completely blocked out, and I had many solid drafts before I came to the incredulous understanding that this was going to happen. And I actually still haven't quite wrapped my head around it, I'm sorry to say. But I thought, on the one hand, you know, this is cataclysmic, and how am I going to publish this book about the need to come home, the need to meet and accept the neighbors and learn to understand their time and their motive and their agency in a country that has just flown in the face of everything that the book is about. But as time has passed, and as the very difficult months of this administration have unfolded, I feel almost grateful to have brought about a book like this at a moment where there might be a whole lot of people who want to hear a story like this, because it is so very different than the story that we're getting every day in the papers, the story that's doubling down on a model of control and mastery and domination of the non-human world, rolling back this half century of incredible work on the part of eco-activists and environmental lawyers to begin to accommodate the wider world. To now be here more than a year into this administration at a place where so much of that half-century work is being undone, I'm just grateful to at least have told one story that might stand in opposition to that.
Richard Powers, once you realize you can't tell the story of trees from the perspective of a tree, you created essentially 8 stories involving 9 people. And these stories interweave to a greater or lesser degree. What brought you to creating that kind of tale, which is almost, I guess, like roots of one story?
Right. In fact, the first section of the book is called Roots, and it unfolds, as you say, almost like 8 sequential short stories, self-contained, and the reader isn't at first aware of anything to link one of these characters to the other, except that each of these characters has some primal experience with a tree, something that opens their eyes to the relationship between their own life and the life of these other creatures that unfold on such a different time frame and under such different circumstances. I did, as you say, you know, my first dream was that, you know, if I was serious about telling a story that challenges this notion of human exceptionalism, this idea that we're somehow outside of or independent of the rest of the living world, wouldn't it be marvelous to let the trees be the protagonists, to have them as, you know, front and center as the characters in the story? And that did have some challenges with regard to keeping a reader's interest.
How far did you get in that?
I struggled with it for a couple of months. And in fact, the ghost of that attempt is in the book, because although I did end up making this necessary compromise of having human proxies as the people who carry the emotional burden of the story, and the book is a traditional story in that regard, you follow the fate of these people, you see their character flaws, you see them bumping up against each other and joining forces with each other, having tragedies and setbacks and so forth. It does unfold in a classic character-driven way. But in and among these nine characters are trees, supporting actors, who get named, who have a presence, who have an agency, and whose nature, dramatic nature, and role in the story is asserted again and again through the eyes of these different characters. So a bit of that attempt, it wasn't a wasted time to try to do that. A bit of that attempt remains in the final shape of the book.
The book itself, the overstory, takes us through about, I guess, 35 years, hard to tell because you're not clear on the years,
right?
Probably specifically for that reason,
right?
To keep it open.
Right.
It deals with variations on things that really happened. One of the centerpieces of the story concerns an attempt by ecological activists to keep an old-growth forest from being destroyed by a man and a company, the guy who's leveraged to buy the company and then needs to sell that off. That's a real story.
And people in this region will recognize the Pacific Lumber story and Charles Hurwitz and Max Sam and Save the Headwaters. And they will also recognize activist interventions farther north, the Deep Creek confrontation and so forth. There are other ghosts of the now legendary Redwood Summer and other characters in this region and in the Pacific Northwest, references to figures, or let's say pastiches or composites of historical characters and historical events. But outside of that 35-year frame, there's a larger, the nine characters' backstories and the associations that it takes them through. And a careful reader will also see the way in which older American stories, American transcendentalism, Thoreau and Whitman and Emerson, but also myths and legends, indigenous myths and legends, not just from this continent, from around the world, and the threads of tree stories as far back as Ovid, for instance, let me sing now about how people turn into other things. Those fabrics are woven through this central drama that has this real-world political antecedent, and it turns those events into a kind of contemporary myth.
Taking nine characters, eight stories, because two of the characters are together, and weaving it, it sounds as if you had the entire outline before you actually sat down and wrote it.
Well, I hope it reads that way, but the truth is, we learn by going where we have to go, and this is the product of 5 years of many, many aborted trails, many out and backs, many loops that I didn't intend to be loops. So a lot of hiking around in the woods, sometimes without a compass, before I did get that final shape and before I was able to groom it into something that feels like a continuous narrative.
Richard Powers, when you're doing your research, and there's a tremendous amount of research, how do you manage to find that balance between getting research into a book and yet understanding that you can't overload the book,
yeah,
because then it just becomes this weird monster of a hybrid.
And I have written some weird monster hybrids. And there was a time when I was a younger man when the project involved very willingly deploying a lot of information, because my goal, you know, for some of the books involved trying to juxtapose or triangulate between a very visceral narrative and a very reflective and ruminative one. So to have drama alongside data was part of the design of some of the earlier books. This is a very different kind of project. I did read copiously for it. 6 years ago, I would have had trouble telling you the difference between a sycamore and a maple. But over the course of these 5 years, I read well over 120 books on the subject of trees, not just the botanical and biological, not just the field guides, but social histories of trees, the politics of the timber wars, you know, basically everything I could get my hands on, and it was absolute delight. I didn't want to read anything else. It was simply my daily bread. It was my daily pleasure. But that's not everybody's daily pleasure. The key was how to make the astonishing things that have been happening and being discovered about trees over the last several decades that have profoundly changed our understanding of what these creatures are and what they're doing. I hope we can get to that. How to take that deeply scientific, deeply empirical revolution and make it compelling drama, put it into the lives of people, subsume it into their concerns, their hopes and their fears and their desires. And while you do learn a heck of a lot about trees by the end of this book, it is as a kind of appendage to the forward motion of the narrative, these nine lives barreling to their conclusions and having their own perception of who they are, their own understanding of how the human came to be changed by the transformation in their understanding of what these other things are, what these other creatures, 100,000 species of creatures up on woody trunks turning sunlight into food.
You're listening to an interview with Richard Powers, whose latest novel is The Overstory. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. You have a character named Patricia Westerford, who does research on tree communication. And I was talking with a friend of mine who is a landscape person, and I mentioned some of the elements of this and how trees communicate with each other, specifically producing insecticides, which is part of Patricia's learning in the book. He said, oh yeah, that research is done. That's real.
All of the science in the book, which a first-time reader might say, sounds like magic realism, sounds woo-woo, as it was one reviewer called it, is in fact grounded in absolutely published, vetted, and confirmed scientific research. So let's talk first about Patricia's early discoveries in over-the-air plant communication. So a tree that's under attack by insects does start to produce its own insecticides. That's pretty remarkable in its own right. She discovers something even more remarkable, which is that that tree under attack begins to pump out airborne chemicals, signals, that alert nearby trees that haven't been attacked by insects to start producing their own insecticides. That somehow these pheromones that are put out over the air are acting as if this woods or forest is part of a shared immune system. So these nearby trees can get going and stave off an attack even prior to the arrival of the insect. And in fact, she discovers that a tree can call in an air force. It can put out signals that attract other kinds of insects, for instance, wasps, to come and prey upon the insects that are feeding on it. This idea that, you know, there's a signal being sent and a signal being received chemically over the air by these trees strikes her colleagues as so outrageous, her male colleagues, I should add, as so outrageous that they ridicule her and ultimately hound her out of the field. And she leaves the discipline in disgrace and she goes underground, and it isn't until years later that she's vindicated. By then, she's on an even wilder project, which is studying the ways in which trees are actually networked together underground by fungal filaments that are connecting the trees in networks of exchanged food and secondary metabolites. This relationship between trees and fungus, I mean, it sounds out of this world. The fungus can't photosynthesize for itself, so its filaments go right into the roots of the trees. The trees supply the fungus with hydrocarbons and sugars. The fungus, in return, is extremely good at extracting minerals and secondary metabolites from the soil and giving them to its host trees. But it's doing even more than that. I mean, the fungus will make little lassos out of its filaments and trap animals, tiny soil invertebrates, springtails, for instance, and digest them and feed them to the trees. And the fungus is distributing food among these trees in a system in what Suzanne Simard, who's a researcher, one of the leading researchers in this study of mycorrhizal connection, calls the wood wide web. Big trees are keeping little trees alive. Healthy trees are healing sick trees. There's an amazing socialist cooperative economy going out there in the woods. The woods that we thought, until a short while ago, were driven entirely by competition.
In terms of cooperation versus Darwinism, you did this amazing interview in the LA Review of Books, and I urge people, if they're still interested, to go and read this. You can find it just by Googling Richard Power's name. You say, climate change denial may be just a manifestation of Jameson's observation that it is easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And I think that ties in directly with what you just said about cooperation versus, I guess, again, you know, survival of the fittest.
Yeah. And scientists who are looking to bring to the public this deepening understanding of how much more important cooperation is than competition are urging new kinds of vocabulary and a real revolution in thought. And some have suggested this not especially elegant word, coopetition, to show that this dependence does have elements of both. The key thing to remember is when we say that natural selection and survival of the fittest is a sculpting that shapes an organism to its environment, the key insight here and in the book is that the environment is mostly living things, right? So to be suited to the environment means to be suited to live in and among the other living things. That's something that we have not done. And that's something in Jameson formulation, that convergence on individualist commodity capitalism that now seems like the inevitable arrival point of cultural processes that we could not arrive at any other configuration. There is no more efficient or appropriate or life-affirming configuration that we could arrive at, is in fact a conjuring act of sorts. It's externalizing costs. It works under the assumption that we have mastered the living world, that we can make it do our bidding. Now the bill is coming due, and all of those stories that we've told that start with this premise that the drama, the conflict between the human and the non-human has been solved, all of those stories have to be thought of again. I believe that literary fiction in the future will be dominated by the growing understanding that the battle that we thought had been finished and judged in our favor is coming back to us with a vengeance.
I keep thinking that as we see this cult of individualism, the cult of Ayn Rand, right, but going further than that, that at the same time we see that, we see the opposite of it in your book and books by Kim Stanley Robinson. Netflix show called Sense8 in which different people can actually kind of meld together. Yeah. These all seem to be pushing against this. So you're getting pushback, but it isn't necessarily in opposition. It's just coming up.
I'm so delighted that you mentioned Kim Stanley Robinson. I admire him as much as I admire any living writer, and he really does have a handle on the largest stories of human destiny. But here's an interesting thing. Sense8 and Robinson belong to this often absurdly isolated or ghettoized domain of science fiction. And I, for whatever reason, have been declared a literary author, but my heart is really with these people who are asking time and time again these questions about the world beyond us. It's the literary authors who have lost that question. They've become completely committed to the psychological novel or the novel of domestic or small-scale social relations. And to go to the vision that is absolutely status quo in science fiction is incredibly salubrious. It's like a breath of fresh air to go into this world where the readers and the writers say, of course we have to be continuing to ask this question about humans versus non-humans. That's the key question. If we're not asking that question, we can't even begin to ask these other questions about how to get along with our spouse or how to get along with the conflicts inside our own private psyches. They are all contingent on this broader question of whether the fundamental story that we're telling about ourselves here on this earth is viable.
If man is separate from everything else, then on one level, some people could say, well, we have mastery over it all. And the others would say, well, let's get rid of ourselves and let the world do whatever it's going to do. But both of those ignore the fact that we are animals and we are living in the world and we can either be parasites or symbiotic.
That's right. And you know, it's interesting because that is the deepest conflict of having a conscious animal. And in a sense, all our stories are about that. This book is ostensibly a book about a handful of people who try to save the trees. But of course, trees don't need saving, and they don't need us to save them. That strategy of arborescence has been around for hundreds of millions of years. It's survived several mass extinctions. And on the eve of this newest human-induced mass extinction, that solution stands as good as any large-scale, large-organism solution. It stands as good as a chance as any to make it through the challenges of the changing world, of the transformed Earth. We're the ones who need saving. We're the upstarts who come along 4 seconds before midnight and whose immense power, immense capacity for transformation is so precarious and proceeds so heedlessly. So the book does a reverse toward the end, and you realize that you're actually reading a plea for a different kind of salvation, one that starts in the transformation of our own ability to look, to see, and to find the miraculous in something that's not us.
A book like The Time of Our Singing changed you. That was the first time I spoke with you. And in that interview in the LA Review, you talk about how this book changed who Richard Powers is.
Well, let me start with a very literal, or a very material thing, which is in the 5 years that I spent researching, I kept reading about where the small pockets of old growth are still left. I should say it will open a lot of people's eyes to hear that of all of the massive, you know, the four incredible, supposedly inexhaustible forests that covered this continent when Europeans first came here, as much as 95% to 98% of it has been cut down, replaced by tree plantations or second growth forest or agricultural land. But of the uncut forest,
there may be only 3 to 5% of what was once existed on the continent. I kept reading about these old growth forests, and for purposes of the book, I wanted to see them, so I traveled to them wherever I could. People repeatedly said that if you want to see an eastern old growth forest, that the Smoky Mountains was a great place to see it. And I went down there about 3 years ago, and you know, I've been in a lot of forests, and I thought I knew what an eastern forest looked like. But when you walk up through the regrowth and into forest that has changed very little for 10,000 years, it's astonishing. And, you know, it smells different, it sounds different, it looks different, the quality of the light is different. You immediately detect a kind of depth and richness of a diversity of species that isn't present in a regrowth forest. I liked it so much that I bought a house there and moved down there, and I've been living there ever since. And that's now in my backyard, and it's now part of my almost daily practice to go down into the woods and walk.
You've been listening to an interview with Richard Powers, whose latest novel is The Overstory. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. An extended version of this interview can be found as a Radio Walensky podcast in the Area 941 section of the kpfa.org website. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Denise. Thank you.
So I'm sure anyone who talks to you must tell some story of when they've been to Italy. And so if you could bear with me, I just want to tell you a little bit of mine. I was there, gosh, about almost 15 years ago with my then husband and my our daughter, who was a toddler at the time. And we had the opportunity to spend the month in Tuscany with a group of friends. And of course, I visited Cortona and was reading Under the Tuscan Sun during that trip. And I'm like, oh, might I get a glimpse of Francis here in the piazza? And I have not been back to Italy since. So I hope to get there someday.
Time to come back.
There you go. And I read your series of memoirs of when you started your journey, your adventure there, and through those subsequent years of living there. And that was such a treat because I felt like I was there with you and Ed.
Thank you. Thank
you. So you have visited, you've lived in many places on this planet, in this world, and now you're landing in two different places. You live in North Carolina and sometimes in Italy. Is that correct?
Yes, we go back and forth. I think I spend a lot of my time in the air, actually. We're almost always here in the summer and always for the olive harvest. But at other times, it just depends on what's going on. But it usually ends up we're here 5 months out of the year in Italy and the rest of the time in a really small town in North Carolina.
Can you tell me how those different places are similar?
They both have that warmth and generosity and sense of hospitality that I knew even as a child growing up in Georgia. When I first came to Italy, I felt so at home here, and I kept thinking, why? And it was that the ambience of the people, just the general tone of interchange and the way people are always ready to drop anything for a conversation. I've just found the Italians, I've been here so long now, and I've found the Italians to be all over Italy, not just in Tuscany, but consistently outgoing and warm. And it is so much like the South. Of course, the South I grew up in has changed tremendously, mostly for the better. And so going back there, living again in North Carolina, it's both a homecoming and it's kind of a new place as well. So there's that about it.
You know, when you were deciding, well, eventually you made the decision to live part-time in Italy, was there ever a moment where you thought, what was I thinking?
Never. Only the night before I bought the house, I was tossing and turning and thinking, this is the craziest thing you've ever done. But once it was my house, it just seemed so natural to be here. And I've never, ever regretted it.
Mm. That's nice to hear. Is it safe to say that your book, Under the Tuscan Sun, just catapulted you into international fame?
It is. I was a poet before that. I'd written 5 books of poetry. I taught poetry at San Francisco State for 100 years, and that was my world. My husband's a poet, too, so we lived and breathed poetry. I wrote a textbook on poetry. But when I got to Italy, something strange happened, and I started writing longer sentences, and the lines didn't want to break, and I kept being more expansive, and before I knew it, I had, without meaning to really, I turned into a prose writer. So I've loved writing prose, and I always have the next project in my mind, even when I'm working on one project. And I kind of go back and forth with books between Italy and the South. I wrote a Southern memoir about 4 years ago, and before that, I wrote one novel, Swan, which was based in the hometown I came from in Georgia.
Do you find
my next book? I'm hoping it's going to be set in the South as well.
Do you find it's hard to jump between those types of writing, whether it's the poetry or prose or your cookbooks? Do you have to do some major mental shift in order to put that together?
That part of the creative process just puzzles me and fascinates me, because I think with different projects you get to a different rhythm in your brain, and it somehow sets you up to shift genres in that way. I don't write poetry anymore. I still read it a lot, but I don't write it anymore. But I've tried to take what I knew about writing poetry into my other books. But something like writing a cookbook, there's a lot of inspiration behind it, but it is such a different process. It's tedious because you have to do the half teaspoon and the pinch and the, you know, just those really exact measurements, which isn't really the way I cook, and it's certainly not the way Italians cook. So that I think is the hardest book I've done, was Tuscan Sun Cookbook. But
I would not have thought that.
I know, but it also helped me because it got all my recipes in one place, and I don't have to search for them anymore.
Is there
the hardest is a novel, because when you write nonfiction, which I've done so much, you write about what's happened, and you make selections, and you boil down things, and you prioritize things, and you write it as well as you can. But when you're writing a novel, you're inventing, and it's coming out of a whole different area of your experience, and things come together and become composites, but then take on lives of their own, and it's just a whole different experience. It's exhilarating. I loved writing the novel that I've recently published, Women in Sunlight. It was so much fun to write. My first novel was really hard. So I'm hoping if I write a third one, I'll just sail right through it.
Is there one book you've been really wanting to write, but for some reason you're just not ready to do that yet?
No, I feel like books kind of form themselves as they come. But I have just finished a book that I had wanted to write for a long time, and that is a book about unknown places in Italy. Mm. So I have just finished that. It's in the editing process now. It's called See You in the Piazza, New Places to Discover in Italy. And for that, the reason I wanted to write it was because I got to go all over Italy and see all these amazing places that I didn't know about, and some that I did know about but I'd never been to, but little tiny places in Puglia and in the Dolomites from top to bottom of Italy. I traveled 150 days in Italy last summer on the road, not counting the time I was here at my house. So that was just a blissful experience. And I had wanted to do that for a long, long time.
It sounds like a marvelous adventure.
It was. We were on trains, boats, planes, cars. My husband's a great traveler. I don't think I could have done it without him. And it was also so much fun to go on this long trip together.
So let's talk about your new book, Women in Sunlight. If you and I met on an elevator, let's say, or let's say in a piazza, how would you describe this book to me?
It's a tribute to friendship, I think, a tribute to so many women I've known, particularly women who travel. And I kind of got the idea from sitting in the piazza in Cortona, my hometown here, and seeing women by themselves with their notebooks, writing in their notebooks or sketching. And I know those women, I know who they are, I know what they're doing there, I've been there, and I'm always fascinated by the quest that brings somebody here, not just to see everything and have fun, which is great too, but somebody who comes here maybe at a junction point in their lives that after this something is going to be different. I started thinking about that one day in the piazza, and I started thinking about women coming here, different kinds of women, and what would be their experience here. Also, as I was getting older, I was getting the message, and several of my friends were too, that it was time to downsize, time to clear out things, time to consider one of those active lifestyle retirement things where there are classes and gourmet meals and all that. And I kind of was seeing some of my friends moving very happily, actually, to some of these places. But it just kind of rubs me the wrong way, because it seems to me as you get older, you don't necessarily have to get smaller and disappear, but to strike out and do something new and to bring back the person you might have always thought you wanted to be, but somehow life interfered, to go back to that person and bring that person into the light, hence the title, Women in Sunlight. These are three different women. Maybe the elevator ride's getting too long now, but it's three very different women, and they have different pasts and problems and ambitions and so forth. And I wanted to see what would happen to them if they got here. So they did, and they met another American woman. So it's really this journey of four women and what Italy encouraged them to do.
You know, Frances,
what did.
Thank you for mentioning the topic or the subject of my interpretation. As we get older, we become more invisible. You say, you know, smaller but more invisible. I'm a woman in my mid-50s, and sort of entering this life experience of feeling, in some cases, a little diminished, but certainly looking internally of saying, you know, is stuff really slowing down, or are there any more big adventures in my life? And I'm actually pursuing one. So it just really lightens my heart for you to mention that, because I know a lot of women, friends that I know, are also kind of having those conversations with themselves. Like,
yes.
Do I just wrap it up here and go, quote unquote, retire? I don't like that word. What do you think of that word, retirement?
No, I would never think of retiring. I mean, if I had a hideous job that I had plugged away at for years, I'd be over the moon to retire. But just to stop and retire is a whole different thing. I think if you get to that point where you have retired, it's just a perfect time to start something new, not to go hide in an anonymous place, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you mentioned that the women, Julia, Camille, Susan, and I'm going to throw Kit in there. They're the four main incredible women, represent a bunch of women in your life. Do any of those characters represent parts of you?
They do. A lot of my interests are in there because they're interested in art and cooking and gardens and travel, and those are some of my major interests. And Kit, who's the narrator of the book, is a writer. So she's a younger woman, but I guess most of my voice is really in her, you know, as a writer. I got the idea that someone would tell the story of the three women. And so she, their neighbor in Italy, became fascinated with them because she wanted to know what would happen and why they were there and what it means to live in a foreign country and what is your departure date mean, if there is one. And, you know, all those questions of the person who leaves and takes up in a country not their own, which is a complicated act.
Well, there's also another character who is not quite in the same space as these other women, Margaret, mysterious Margaret. Margaret. Where did she come from? And what is her character's purpose in the story?
She actually had a real inspiration for me. I met the writers Anne Cornelison and Claire Sterling when I first came to Italy. They were older. They had been in Italy since the 50s, and they were both fierce, independent writers. And I loved both of them. And Margaret is nothing like them in circumstance, but in her, you know, fierceness, she's very much like these two women. So she originated from there, but she took on her own character. And I just let her go with who she was, who she was becoming. The other characters, too, I became so enamored of them. I sometimes wake up in the morning and think, what are they doing down there in that villa below me? The villa isn't really there, but I kind of still am imagining them going forward.
And all of the characters are likable. I mean, was that intentional?
Yes. I wanted to give them their time in the sun, and I wanted them to discover this great friendship, which doesn't take the place of anything in the past, but it becomes a new kind of family. Because that's another thing that I had been thinking about a lot, is how so many people, when they get older, they're lonely. And if they just explored more options for living with other people, it might change things. So these women did, and it's worked out well for them. One of the things in the book is they've taken the house for a year, a lease. So at the end, will they go, will they stay? That was one of the things I was playing with in the in writing. I didn't exactly know myself until close to the end.
Well, I'm hoping you can read a little snippet of the book. It was hard for me to pick a piece, so I just went with the one that for some reason really resonated with me. And it starts on page 85. I want to say it is The White Wisteria, chapter White Wisteria. I'm wondering if you could read that segment for our audience.
This part takes place when they're still in North Carolina, and the three women have just met, and they are becoming friends at this point. But they don't yet know right here that what's going to happen to them. They don't know they're going really to Italy. They are at one of the characters, Susan, has a beach house in North Carolina, and she's invited them there at kind of the beginning of their friendship. Blitz to wake up to the sound of waves rolling in. Julia is the first one up. When Camille and Susan wander into the kitchen in their robes around 9, she has waffle batter ready, juice poured, and a pan of bacon already made. You accomplish everything effortlessly, Camille says. I consider it a major event when Charlie brings his family over for quiche and salad for Sunday brunch, and how orderly the kitchen is. My secret weapon, clean up as you go. After breakfast and a beach walk, they drive into Wilmington, where the gracious neighborhoods invite them to stroll and make up stories about the inhabitants of the white houses, all surrounded by pink and white azaleas. They buy carnations and lavender soaps for Susan's house and stop for ice cream cones in the old town. After lunch at a waterfront cafe, Susan finds new walking shoes and Julia shows them some of Mulberry Press's publications in the bookstore. In the art section of the bookstore, Camille selects tubes of watercolor paint, six brushes, and paper. I might as well paint a big cliched sunset, she jokes. But she's excited to think of taking the paints down to the dunes. This is the first time she's bought paints in how many years? She cannot remember.
That is so representative of your writing style that I love. It brings me as a reader right into the moment as though I'm sitting there or walking around the streets. Right. Yeah, so thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Do you, I mean...
That shows that Camille, her journey once she gets to Italy is going to be to become the painter that she set out to be and ended up being a part-time art history teacher. So each of these women has done a version of what they wanted to do, but not the full-blown ambition.
But they blossom in Italy.
They get to do that.
Yes, that's a wonderful. I mean, it's so idyllic. It's a normal, or not normal, but a real life experience. But it feels somewhat magical the way you describe it.
Thank you.
So I want to talk about something I've learned so much by reading Women in Sunlight, and that is the Stendhal syndrome. Did I say that correctly?
Oh yes, that's a scene from. The writer Stendhal, who wrote The Red and the Black, and he describes what happens when you get to, say, Florence, and you're just overcome by beauty. You can't take it anymore. You feel dizzy and you have to sit down. And so over the years, people have started calling that the Stendhal syndrome, and you do see it a lot in Italy. People just they can't take anymore because they've taken in so much. I was walking behind a couple in Pienza one day, and I heard this man wail. He was a Southern man, so I recognized his accent. He said, "I've seen all I want to see." I knew how he felt. That was Stendhal syndrome.
Have you experienced it yourself in the course of your life visiting?
Constantly.
I
was just in Milano last week, and about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I said, "I've had it. I can't take in another thing." So you just have to pause and let yourself regroup.
I was in Paris with a friend earlier this year and had many of those experiences when I was there. It was pretty amazing. It's also kind of like having these mindful moments of... being fully in the experience and letting all that beauty in. I learned something. So thank you very much. I hope to have many more of those kinds of experiences.
Thank you. You too.
So the image on the book is a woman jumping into a body of water. I'm suspecting that was intentional.
Yes. One of my favorite parts to write in the book was when Julia, who has had the most troubled past, is at Cinque Terre, and she sees people jumping into the clear, beautiful water from this cliff. And she's alone there. The others are doing something else. And she finds herself walking up to this cliff, and she's not about to go because it is so far down there. But then she gets right to the edge, and one of the young boys behind her shouts out, "Vai, vai, go, go." And she suddenly looks down and she jumps. Mm. And then she goes home and she tells her other friends about it. But it was one of those moments for her, which was a breakthrough, where the past that had held her back, or she had experienced difficulties in, it was some kind of a metaphorical transformation for her to take the leap, so to speak, and fall down into this gorgeous clear water. So that was a wonderful thing to write, because I've done that myself, and it was really scary. But I wanted her to experience it too.
Taking the leap into the unknown, being scared out of your wits, but luckily, and maybe typically, just being so pleasantly surprised with the outcome.
Yes. In the movie Under the Tuscan Sun, the screenwriter had a line, it wasn't my line, but I really liked it. She said, "Life gives you 1,000 chances, you just have to take one." And I thought, I don't know about that. But I realized that it is, so much of life is chance. Any little decision you would have made to do something different would make you into a wholly different person. So I'm so aware of that, you know, the chance aspect, and taking the chance. If you don't, this is what happens. If you do this, you know, you're on a whole different path. So I think taking chances is scary, but I once did it when I bought this house. It was a chance for me. Now you hear about people renting villas all over the place or buying them in all kinds of countries. But at that time, this was in 1990, I didn't know anybody who had ever done that. And I plunked down my life savings to take this crazy chance. And I think because it worked out so well, it has given me all the time since more of a willingness to take chances. And so taking a chance often opens new places for you to move into, looking for the next largest space.
Well, that's a perfect way to segue into my final question for you. My reading your book, Women in Sunlight, came at this perfect time in my own life, because I touched on it a little bit earlier in our conversation. I'm actually leaping into my own big adventure. I've lived in Oregon for about 2 decades now, and now I'm moving back to the East Coast, to Rhode Island. It's like mind-blowing. And I don't know really anyone there, but everything seems to be rolling out the way it needs to say, you know what, Denise, you're making a good choice. I'm here to support you. Looking forward for yourself, Frances, what do you see as your next big adventure?
Well, my next book is always my next adventure. And I'm writing a book with another travel writer, Ondine Cohen, called The Best of Italy. And we're writing it for National Geographic. So that's my next adventure. But beyond that, I want to go to India. I want to go back to Turkey. I haven't been in several years. And I have several remodeling projects in my future, near future. And that's about it, I guess. I'd probably come up with some other wild ideas pretty soon.
Frances, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Denise. It was such a pleasure talking to you.
That was best-selling writer Frances Mays talking about her new book, Women in Sunlight. You can learn more about Frances and all of her books by visiting francismaysbooks.com.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Rosewood Health Fair on Thursday, July 16th from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. at the Rosewood Family Health Center in Portland. The Rosewood Health Fair will provide health and wellness resources to the community, along with sports, physicals, and immunizations for children. There will be food, games, prizes, and a variety of community resources for families. Again, that's Rosewood Health Fair on Thursday, July 16th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Rosewood Family Health Center, 8935 Southeast Powell Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found on the kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Radioland. I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I want you to listen to and support KBOO because Portland needs it, you need it, and the world needs it. Ubalagani! Boing, boing.